What's up, everyone? My name's Nick.
And I'm Em.
And welcome into the Ominous Archives. All right, Em. There's not much we're going to dive into, because this is possibly going to be a long one.
Nick said, let's cut right to the info.
Right into it.
We're going right into it.
Right into it. Well, we're covering a very, how do I want to phrase this? Some say still America's sweetheart. Some, like, very inspirational.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can even say, like, a go-getter for this week.
Interesting. Who the heck are we talking about?
We are going to be talking about Amelia Earhart.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Good pick.
Yeah.
That's a really good pick. And everything that you just said, I think, yep, checks out.
Absolutely. It checks. Yeah.
Badass woman.
Yeah, she's definitely somebody that everybody should look up to.
For sure.
Definitely broke a lot of boundaries and stuff like that. And
I literally did a project on her in fifth grade, and I will never forget doing that project on her in fifth grade. Like,
There's obviously a ton on here. There's a ton of documentaries, a ton of books, a ton of podcasts. I've listened to probably 8 of them.
Honestly, she deserves it. Give the girl her flowers. Like, I love it.
So I plan on taking it a little differently, kind of being more vague with things and stuff, just because if this isn't going to be like a deep dive.
Right.
There's so much about her life that's going on and all that stuff. I just kind of want to, you know, just give an overview. I've listened, like I said, to a bunch of podcasts, and there's so many people out there who do the deep dives and everything. Right. And I feel for this topic, I don't know what I was expecting, but I definitely not trying to keep everybody here for like 2 hours because there's so much info, and she's just awesome. So
I'm excited.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start on July 2nd, 1937. We have a Lockheed Electra twin-engine monoplane slicing through the warm skies above the Pacific Ocean. Inside, the world's most famous female aviator, Amelia Earhart, and her navigator, Fred Noonan. They're en route to this tiny piece of land called Howland Island. The problem is, they never make it. They never land. And they don't come back. So, before we get, well, we already got to the point where they never come back. And everybody kind of knows that. But her story all begins when she was born on July 24th, 1897. I never realized that she disappeared on the 2nd. But her birthday was 22 days later. I'm not going to be able to say this all day. Atchison, Kansas.
We're not in Kansas anymore.
No, they definitely weren't. So she had like a unconventional, rebellious kind of childhood. It was driven by curiosity, and that curiosity kind of what propelled her to become the legend that she is. She climbed trees, had scraped knees, tangled hair. She built homemade sleds out of scrap wood, flew down hills like they were runways. Her father gave her a .22 caliber rifle to hunt rats with. She just loved, like, being outside.
Exploring. She knew who she was from an early age.
Yeah, and the other thing, too, is, you know, a lot of people will say, for that era and everything, like, that wasn't what women did.
Right.
And her parents, her mom, at least, definitely fed into be you.
Yeah.
Do what you want to do.
I love
and
that.
And I think that's really cool because it, look what it did. It propelled
look where it got her. Parents take notes.
Yeah. Like I just said, her parents, they encouraged her boldness. They praised the fact that she was independent. They wanted her to be fearless, defy expectations, and not just fall into the role of society, but be yourself. They unknowingly were preparing her for the emergence of a new age, an age that would sweep away old traditions especially ones that told girls to stay small, quiet, and grounded.
Period.
Yep. And at the age of 7, after her mother, we were just talking about this earlier.
Yeah.
We kind of did, you know, preview what we're talking about, but her mother said she couldn't ride a roller coaster at the 1904 fair in St. Louis, which is, like, the world fame. It's apparently, like, crazy. But Amelia, instead of, like, throwing a tantrum and freaking out, she went home, raided her dad's tool shed, built her own version, 2x4s, nailed it to the roof, took a wooden crate, made a cart, some roller skate wheels, boom, made her own roller coaster.
Like, the creativity, mm-hmm. first of all, it's, at what, 7, you said?
Seven.
Seven?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
I love it.
And with her childhood, like I said, there's so much more.
Mm-hmm.
Just to kind of off the top of my head, at one point, she would spend, I think it was winters with her grandparents. Obviously, there's two seasons. It's like, it's either winter or summer.
Yeah.
She spent one of them with her grandparents and then would go back to her parents. Her father had a really good job, kind of gave in to alcohol, lost a job, bounced around. So, like, she had a very crazy kind of home life, in
right,
a way.
It wasn't all glitz and glamour, no. type of thing. Yeah.
She was educated at home mm-hmm. until 12, and then she attended public school in Des Moines, Iowa. That's when, like I was saying, things changed. Her father was charming but unstable, succumbed to alcoholism, yeah. lost his job, and the family at home ended up getting auctioned off. And at 17, Amelia's innocence just kind of evaporated. The real world kind of hit her.
Yeah, it hits you fast.
Mm-hmm. That lesson stayed with her forever,
mm-hmm.
so she never depended on anyone else, not even her husband, not for happiness, not for money, all her. She's independent.
Yeah.
She obviously despised alcohol, yeah. as anyone in that situation would.
Yeah.
She developed a relentless fear of poverty,
mm.
which, I mean, I feel that's kind of like everybody's fear. Like, nobody wants to yeah. lose what they have, but, like, when you hit that point,
when it happens to you, yeah,
that's when
you know the feeling.
That's when you know it.
Yeah, you don't want that to happen.
That's
again.
When that fear, like, sets in. You're like, this is not, yeah. You know, not going to happen. She vowed to herself to never let her dreams be shackled by someone else's failures. So, like I said, they bounced around moving wise, and she ended up picking Hyde Park High School. I believe it was in Chicago,
hmm.
and there she fell in love with science and engineering, while other girls were studying etiquette. Amelia was studying engines. She devoured books about women breaking barriers, and she even kept a scrapbook of their stories.
It's amazing to me that she, like, was so young and, like, knew that that's what she mm-hmm. wanted to do. Like,
we'll get there. She didn't know she wanted to fly.
Well, yeah, she knew that she wanted to do something,
she
like...
She wanted to be independent. Yeah. She wanted to do everything on her own.
Something that wasn't yeah. being done. Mm-hmm. Like...
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could just tell, like, right off the bat, she was so driven.
She's quoted at one point saying, some men are better, and that's, I don't know the exact quote, but it's like, some men are better at baking, and some women are better at repairing, or mm-hmm. At being mechanics.
Yeah.
Like, there's a quote that she says that, or something along those lines. And it's true. I mean, I went to automotive school. There were plenty of women there, and I started knowing nothing about cars, and just talking to some of them, I was just like, why do you need school? Like, you seem like you know everything already, but it's just all, I guess, your niche.
Yeah.
At one point, the war came. She ended up moving to Toronto to care for wounded World War I soldiers, men with missing limbs, blinded by gas, or just shattered by trauma. But death struck closer. During the Spanish flu pandemic, she became gravely ill with pneumonia and cyanotinitis, sinus infection. That actually nearly killed her.
Damn.
Mm-hmm. And when she moved to Toronto, she was visiting her sister. And that's mm-hmm. kind of what sparked the whole thing, because her sister was involved in it and stuff. She does. Right. She has a sister. She never fully recovered. She did. Like, it was one of those, she recovered, but she didn't. For the rest of her life, she suffered from chronic headaches and infections.
I didn't know that.
And sometimes she had to wear a bandage on her cheek to hide a drainage tube. And that made flying harder and more painful.
Yeah, I had no idea about that.
I can only imagine. Because when I have a sinus headache,
yeah.
sometimes just the room temperature is just not having it.
Dude, even, like, sometimes, like, moving your head the wrong way, it's, like,
you're just, like, hell. Done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, like I said, we're kind of staying real vague.
Yeah.
With, like, her life and everything, and even with the flights and all that stuff. It's more of a conversation. I just kind of want to talk about it.
All right.
Do I do it justice? I want her and Freddie to do, like, the justice I want to do to them is just talking about how inspiring it is.
Mm-hmm.
So, she had no intention of kind of staying grounded, especially when it came to the sky, which was considered a man's domain.
Mm-hmm.
Amelia said she wanted in. So while she was nursing soldiers from the aftermath of World War I in Toronto, she visited the Canadian National Exhibition, which was just like another enormous fair.
Yeah.
And the highlight of the day was a flight demonstration by a decorated World War I ace. So he was performing some like aerial acrobatics and looping. And he was like diving at the crowd and kind of having them all like run away and scatter.
Yeah.
And Amelia and her friend were kind of walking in a field, like, away from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided he was going to turn and veer towards them. And he was, like, just barreling down at them.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, like, getting ready for them to, like, run for cover. And her friend just took off.
Right.
And
that would be me.
The problem was Amelia just didn't even flinch. She just kind of stared at it. And
she's such a badass. Like, not even a flinch.
Yeah. And it was at that point she said that the red plane spoke to her and began to pique her interest. And after that one afternoon, Amelia and her father attended an air show in Long Beach. And for $10, her dad bought her a 10-minute flight with the pilot Frank Hawks. This was kind of an attempt to mend that fragile relationship, like I said.
That she had with her dad. Yeah, I feel that.
In any of the stuff, they'll cover it. Their relationship got fractured because of the alcoholism. And I don't think I ever heard he was abusive or anything, but just the way he was. It was a fractured thing, and this was an attempt to try and mend it. And as the plane soared above Southern California, that's when something inside her shifted. Quote, "By the time I had gotten 200 or 300 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly," is what Amelia said.
Yeah. You get that feeling, like, instantly, like, when you figure, like, out something you, that, like, yeah, just you want to do. Know
it's what you want to do.
Yeah. Yep,
it clicks. And like you said, what do we say? It's like a shift.
Mm-hmm.
Something just shifts in you, and you're just like, this is it. So she ended up taking on odd jobs. Stenographer, truck driver, photographer, just to afford her flying lessons. So her first instructor, Anita Nett Snook, remembered a woman with no fear of altitude, failure, or men watching her from the sidelines. Now, she did shift instructors at one point. I think she shifted to Anita. I can't remember. She ended up buying a secondhand yellow Kinner Airstar, a patchy little plane that she nicknamed the Canary.
I knew that.
Did you?
I did from my project in fifth grade. I literally remember that. I don't know why.
Chime in whenever you want.
I always remember that she nicknamed her, the Canary. It's now, a little yellow plane.
This plane was loud, temperamental, and it was barely held together. But it was also, I believe it was these planes, you can lift it up from the tail and just walk it around. Like, it was that's that insane. Light.
Like, that's crazy. I don't know if I'm trusting that to fly.
Look at the picture of it.
I know. That little hinky-dinky, tiny airplane.
The crazy thing is, she ended up selling it. I think she ended up selling it to help her family out.
Yeah.
And the pilot who bought it ended up crashing it and dying.
No way.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
See, that's a little wild.
Mm-hmm. She is a, she actually has a statement saying something about it. But it was one of those kind of like, wasn't on me.
Yeah, right. Sorry.
So, now she is obviously getting her flying experience. Had the Canary, sold it, and then in 1927 is when Charles Lindbergh captivated the world by flying solo from New York to Paris. The very next year, all eyes turned toward the Atlantic again, this time looking for a woman to brave it. Enter Amelia Earhart.
Enter my girl.
Now, at this time, she wasn't the most experienced female pilot at the time, nor the most decorated. But what she had was a rare balance. She looked the part the press wanted, tall, slim, photogenic, and she had already logged more than 500 hours in the air.
Right.
Now, this was kind of a race, because there was at least one other woman who was trying to do this.
Yeah.
And Amy Philip Guest, who was a wealthy heiress, who originally intended to make the flight herself. She was the other woman who wanted to do it. Like I said, there was at least two of them. But she got pressure from her family, and she kind of, like, bowed out and was like, fine, but I'm going to fund it anyway. Mm. I want a woman to do this.
Yeah, she was that determined.
And she was very specific, because the other woman who was doing it apparently wasn't the greatest.
Mm.
So she was like, if somebody's going to do this, I want them to be exactly kind of what we talked about, you know, what they were looking for. Now, through publisher George Putnam, the team searched for a woman who could fly as a passenger on this perilous journey. And Amelia was the first person they called, because I think she just got done talking to one of Putnam's, like, contacts or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we think we know who should do this.
Right. I know just the gal.
And they talked to Amelia, didn't talk to anybody else.
Right.
That's also when she met George, and they eventually married.
Hmm.
Now, he also became her publisher, obviously, because he was in public relations, and he did all of that.
Right.
So, like, anything published was pretty much done by him.
Yeah.
And
easy enough.
She did agree to doing this flight, knowing all the risks. Three men have already died trying to run that same route that year. So the risks were pretty high.
Yeah.
But on June 27th. Now I'm making up dates. On June 17th, 1928, she boarded the Friendship in Tarapacy, Newfoundland, and spent the next 20 hours and 40 minutes wedged between fuel tanks in the back of the plane. Storms battered them, the radio went dead, they got lost, and for a while, they weren't sure they were going to make it. But they did. They landed. Right off the coast of Wales. It was cold, cramped, but they were very much alive.
And thank God.
Yep. At that point, the world just kind of went off. Headlines proclaimed her Lady Lindy, the female Lindbergh, and pretty much overnight she was famous.
All right.
Now, Amelia, being the person that she was, she called herself just baggage, like a sack of potatoes. And, I mean, she never piloted the plane.
Right.
She didn't touch the pilot controls.
Yeah.
She just flew in the plane. That's all she did.
Right.
Now, there is a story where she was pivotal because apparently the pilot was drinking.
Oh, perfect.
And there was like a small window they had to get out on to make like the next leg of the journey or to make the journey or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pivotal. She got him into the plane and just figured his pilot instincts were going to take over.
Yeah. Damn.
So, like, if she wasn't there,
right.
It would have never. So yeah. She was important.
Yeah.
But as far as doing anything, she was like, I just sat there.
You know what's so funny? I was literally just about to say, I was like, why? They were all hyped that she was just, like, on the plane.
Mm-hmm. They were all hyped because she was just on the plane.
She didn't even slay.
Mm-hmm. That's all they wanted. That's apparently, that was, you know, big for women back then, even though she could fly the plane.
Yeah.
So after landing, she published her first book called 20 Hours and 40 Minutes. Our Flight on the Friendship. She got that out in like 2 weeks.
That's insane.
I think George was like, you need to get this out. And she wrote it in George's house. At that point, I think he was still married.
Hmm.
So he wrote it in the house, and she actually dedicated the book to his ex-wife. Yeah. That story.
Messy.
Again, that's a whole nother story thing. And from all the stuff that I gathered, it's not like bad blood. It wasn't like he left his wife for Amelia. They kind of, like, they mutually split. Now, if you talk to the wife's family, they think one thing, but because his wife, after they split, apparently it was, like, a month later she remarried.
Mm.
So it wasn't, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It wasn't, like, I guess, dirty laundry on them. Now, in 1932, exactly 5 years after Lindbergh's transatlantic feat, Amelia flew solo across the Atlantic. this time from Newfoundland to Ireland. Ice glazed her wings, lightning split the sky, and her fuel gauge danced dangerously near empty. But yet, she still landed, and she was alone.
Period.
Yep. Also on that trip, I believe there was a gas line for spare tank or for something that was dripping, and it would drip on the back of her head.
Oh my god.
Hmm. Yeah. And at that point, she didn't stop there. One thing I will say, from the info I gathered and everything, she didn't seem record hungry.
Yeah.
She didn't seem like she was doing everything to set a record.
Yeah. She was doing it for herself
and to show, like, women can do this.
Yeah, she was doing it mm-hmm. for us. She was doing it for all the women.
And the other thing, and it's kind of how I guess how I kind of view, we'll call them, like, the masculine trades and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
Yeah.
A lot of the male pilots, when, like, the females would get their license, they were like, we're for it. You want to risk your butt right. up here with us?
Seriously.
Go for it. Like, we're all
it's
for
a
it.
Very,
you know, like, what I mean?
Respectable thing. Like, yeah.
I feel like it's the outside noise.
Yeah.
You get, like, the egotistical males on the mm-hmm. outside who are like, oh, women can't do blah. But it's like, if you were a female pilot back then, I bet you, there's bad eggs in everybody.
Oh, yeah.
But I bet you most of the other male pilots, and from stuff I heard, it sounded like they were, like,
with it.
Why can't they?
Yeah.
You know? So in 1935, she became the first person, not just a woman, to fly solo from Hawaii to California. Another first, another record.
Yeah, and that wasn't even the first woman. First person, mm-hmm. period.
Yeah. Like I said, she wasn't chasing headlines. She was chasing meaning. So she co-founded the 99s. It's an organization for women in aviation. And they used her fame to push for equality.
Love.
The 99s actually got their name from the amount of responses they got back from fellow aviatrix. So it's a female aviator.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool.
Yeah,
I think aviatrix
cool.
sounds so much cooler than aviator. And the 99s, they still exist to today. And they have about 7,000 plus members.
Period.
Mm-hmm. Now for Amelia, she had one final challenge left. She wanted to circumnavigate the globe and be the first woman to do so. So she actually, little background, taught at Purdue for a little while.
Period. Teacher.
mm-hmm. And to help her along this journey, Purdue University established the Amelia Earhart Fund for Aeronautical Research, and they gave $50,000 to fund the purchase of the Lockheed Electra 10E airplane.
Dang.
Yep.
A lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
God, especially wait, then, that's a
then,
lot of 50K. Money.
What do you think an airplane costs now?
Right. Seriously. Mm-hmm. Perspective.
Yeah. So like I said, I've been very vague. Because
yeah.
it is more of like a discussion kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many people out there who've dove deep into it. I just kind of want to touch the surface of everything and hopefully, you know, I guess pique interests. Wow,
yeah.
Like, you know, she sounds really cool. Let me investigate more, you know. It was July 1936. The Lockheed Aircraft Company built the airplane, which was fitted with extra fuel tanks and other extensive modifications. Earhart dubbed the twin-engine monoplane her flying laboratory. It was built at Lockheed's plant in Burbank, California. Now, she had all that stuff, like, fitted, the extra tanks, because they knew they were going to need them.
Right.
Fuel becomes a big thing in this. She knew they were going to need that. What else? They had a bunch of, like, new radio equipment, which I kind of find fascinating. I don't get too deep into it.
Yeah.
Because there's, you'll see when we get, like, a little deeper with the flights. There's some communication issues that happen.
Mm.
And there's some stuff that you're kind of just like, well,
yeah.
Part of me is like, I get it, but at the same time, I'm like, you should have. So, Earhart chooses Captain Harry Manning as her navigator. Now, Manning was also a pilot, and he was also a skilled radio operator who knew Morse code. So, Manning decided to take some time off of work and go for the trip. Now, the original plan was a two-person crew, Earhart would fly, and Manning would navigate. So the tea, or the drama with Manning, his nav ability kind of popped up. George wasn't too confident in it.
Got it.
They apparently took one flight, and Manning navigated them 20 miles off of course, and they're flying like over a state line, so it was kind of like okay, because a tolerable amount to be off was 30 miles. And he came in at 20.
Yeah, but...
So then George...
Yeah.
Wanted a night flight. And he was off again during a night flight. So at that point...
I can see the concern a bit.
Yeah. That's where Fred Noonan was chosen as a second navigator. Because of the extra factors. He was an expert at celestial navigation. Pretty sure that's navigating with the stars.
That's what celestial means.
He just saying. I needed to, you know, making sure.
I had to.
I've heard it like a bunch of times, and I was like, I just know it's navigating with the stars. But for anybody who doesn't, that's what it is. And gladly called me out on it. So Noonan, he was a licensed ship captain and was experienced with both marine and flight navigation.
See, I feel like he's already more qualified. Yeah.
He worked for Pan America World Airways, or Pan Am, and he actually created most of their flights, like their cross-country flights and stuff. He's the one who designed their routes.
Okay, yeah.
So, the little buzz with him was apparently he was also an alcoholic.
Oh, great. Perfect for her. Just what she needs.
Yeah. Now...
That's not triggering or anything.
No. It said that nobody ever knew him to drink on the job.
Oh, well, that's good.
But... Apparently, it was known that he was an alcoholic.
Still a problem.
Yeah. So, the original plan was Noonan would navigate from Hawaii to Howland Island, which was the difficult portion of the flight, because Howland, you know, was very, very small. And then Manning was going to continue with Amelia to Australia, and after that, she would proceed on her own for the remainder of the project.
Oh, okay. So, like, all three of them to start?
They were going to start, so he was going to, Noonan was going to do the hard part of the navigation because Howland Island didn't have a runway.
Yeah.
The U.S. government built a runway for her because more of the stuff, like I said, we were very vague.
Yeah.
She became friends with, I think it was Theodore Roosevelt and his wife.
That's like absolutely like, insane. Like
really good friends with them.
Yeah.
So they built a runway for her there. She, you know. I forget how they ended up doing it. You know, the government, they did some things. Yeah, built. It was a one-time use runway.
Right.
And that was the plan. Noonan would navigate that hard part.
Right.
After that, Manning would then take her from there to Australia. I think even that was like a couple stops away.
Right. But,
and at Australia, he would leave and then she would do the rest
and
on her
own. Okay.
And it's just her.
Got it.
So on March 17th, 1937... they set out on the first leg of her round-the-world flight. The first leg of this attempt going to be between Oakland, California and Honolulu, Hawaii. The crew's next destination after that would be Howland Island. It's a very small island in the Pacific. The thing is, the flight never left Luke Field after they landed in Hawaii. During the takeoff run from Hawaii, there was an uncontrolled ground loop. Now, I didn't know what a ground loop was. They're mainly for, like, a tail-dragging type of plane. Due to the layout of how those planes are, they can get hard. They can be hard to control when there are strong winds. And it can turn the plane sharply and cause damage, which is what happened in this case.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known what that was.
So, what ended up happening is Amelia thought the right landing gear broke. Some other people say the tire popped. Some people say it was pilot error. Some people say it was an accident.
Right, just coincidence.
Either way, the plane was damaged to the point where they had to ship it back.
Oh, damn.
To California. I heard one place say fly it back, but mainly people say they put it on a boat and shipped it back. Because of that, the time off that Manning had came to an end. So, he had to leave. So then, in May of 1937... Amelia took off from Oakland, California, on her second attempt to fly around the world at the equator. Now, what's different from this than everybody else is the equator's bigger. Mm-hmm. It's longer. It's 29,000 miles.
That's insane.
No pilot's ever completed that.
Yeah.
They've all gone, like, up over, kind of like how you would fly to, like how we flew to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
We went up through New York, Canada, across all that over there, over, like, Ireland and all them, and then down.
Yeah.
She's going down and then across the equator around.
Flying is literally so beyond wild to me.
Mm-hmm.
So crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, shout out to all the pilots for real. Like, such a crazy job.
Oh, yeah. It's a wild job. So, they decided to reverse the original westward course. So, from Oakland to Hawaii to Howland, etc. East. Because they wanted to avoid bad weather. And the winds kind of were directing that way. So, it would make it a little easier to fly. So, they went east. They flew from California to Miami. And then down to South America. And at that point, across the Atlantic to Africa. Through India and Southeast Asia. So, a little bit of extra info I know about this. They didn't say anything about the California to Miami flight. She just did it. They didn't say anything. They didn't make a big deal.
She just did it.
The Miami one, they made the big deal. And even then, I think they said it at, like, the last minute. So, like, a ton of press and stuff couldn't get there.
Right.
The rest of it, huge, not huge parties, but, like, a lot of the places she landed were, like, people were just, like, out and, like, seeing her and all that stuff. Yeah. At one point, her scarf gets ripped apart.
Oh.
And people take pieces of her scarf. Yeah. So, that journey was grueling. There was long days of flight that brought them through Dakar, Katram, Bangkok, Darwin, and then by June 29th, they reached Lae, New Guinea. So, after all that, they've covered about 22,000 miles of the 29,000.
That's crazy.
They've just one final stretch that remained, and it was the 7,000-mile flight across the Pacific to Howland Island. Like we said earlier, it's a flat speck of land that's barely even visible in perfect conditions. So, it's a shot in the dark, kind of.
Right.
Now, this is what Noonan was brought on for.
This is your job, buddy.
He was going west to east, if you think about it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're flying west the first time, now we're coming east. But either way, there are more, like, details and things that happened. A radio went out at one point.
Mm-hmm.
They fixed it. Some other, like, small things happened, and they were able to get everything fixed. So, Amelia, this is one of the things I was going to talk about. Amelia removed the telegraph transmitter to save some weight, relying solely on voice communication. Now, she and Noonan were not trained in Morse code, and one thing to note is that she only had about an hour's worth of training on her new radio equipment.
Oh, that's great.
So they removed one to save weight.
Right.
Which is like I think that's the Morse code, the doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo. I think that's what they removed. But she had fitted on there all kinds of new radios. She had a receiver, so she could receive info from, people on the radio. And the same back. And because of all the planning and stuff, she only got about an hour. And that's my thing where I kind of go back and forth. I put a little blame on her because it's right. Like, you should know this stuff. Like, you are independent and you relied on somebody else at that point to do things. But on the flip side, I just work a normal mechanic job.
Right.
But we've also get to the point, because we deal with planes and stuff, to where I see how chaotic and everything things get.
Mm-hmm.
So I completely see how she didn't have the time to do training.
Right.
You know, it was always kind of like, oh, I'll get there, but then this pops up. I'm going to get that, and then this pops up. Or, you know, oh, I got to inspect this, I got to inspect that. So I completely understand that. I'm not blaming and faulting and saying that's why.
Yeah.
No. Things get crazy, but it is noted that she only had about an hour's worth of training on that equipment. And at this point, there were also some concerns about Noonan's behavior and fitness. She hinted that she had personnel unfitness in a telegram to her husband, and this was the second time that she mentioned it. The first was through a phone call, but George and he had two other people listening. They all said they heard personnel problems, but that also sounds like personal problems.
Right.
Like, there's so many things that could be.
Yeah.
But apparently in this letter, it was personnel unfitness. Mm. On July 2nd, 1937, they departed Ley at 10 a.m. local time, and the U.S. Coast Guard cutter, the Itasca, waited off Howlin Island. So they were going to guide them in. But the coordination was kind of flawed. Amelia couldn't receive any of the ship's transmissions. Her equipment wasn't fully capable of the frequencies that they were using. And a vital direction-finding station on the island apparently had dead batteries.
Perfect.
Now, when she took off from Ley, they say in pictures, there was a big antenna that was on the bottom of her plane that apparently was missing.
Oh, great.
So, in the pictures of, I think it's Ley, she, like, they have something of, like, her landing, and it's there. Mm-hmm. And then she has to take off, and it's missing.
Mm.
So, like, it fell off at some point.
Right.
And, like I said, this is why, we're very, very general in all of this. And it was, after more than 14 hours in the air, Earhart radioed, quote, "We are circling, but cannot see island, cannot hear you." Her signals were strong, which meant she was, like, close.
Right.
But she never saw Howland. It said at one point that, like, some of her communications were coming in so loud that they thought it was going to blow out the headphones or the speakers of the Itasca.
Bang.
Mm-hmm. But because of that, like, frequency discrepancy and all that stuff, there are so many other communications, too. She is communicating with them a lot. They can hear her. She's, like, faint. And she gets stronger up until, like, that one where she, like, blows out their speakers. So now we go from that little bit, which was kind of them saying, like, "We're here, can't find you." Like, with all these communications and stuff, they're, like, right on top of them. They're flying at 1,000 feet. There's also a discrepancy about fuel.
Mm.
Now, I learned there's, like, the difference in gas, like, imperial gallons and metric gallons. So some people are like, "No, she didn't have enough gas. She had 950 gallons. Well, if you convert, and they even think 950 was misheard. They think it's 915.
Mm.
Some people say that. If she only had 915 gallons. Well, if that's metric and you convert it to imperial, that's about 1,115 gallons, which is what people say she took off of Ley with, which, like, gives them just, not just enough, but enough to get there.
Right.
So, the whole fuel thing, I think that's a, if you hear people being like, "No, she didn't have enough," you know.
It's give or take.
We'll probably never know. Right. But
I guess we'll never
know. If you're looking at imperial versus metric, there you go. It makes sense. Her final transmission on July 2nd, 1937, came in at 8:43 a.m. Quote, "We're on line 157-337. We're running north and south," end quote. The transmission from Amelia was faint, incomplete, and the voice was strained, possibly panicked.
Mm.
Now, the Coast Guard cutter Itasca waited near Howlin Island, and its crew heard Earhart's last words, but she never heard them. Their signals never reached her. They also pumped smoke into the air for her.
Yeah.
And the weather reporting for that day was, like, clear skies.
Right.
It wasn't, like, overcast or anything. Yeah. So them pumping this black smoke from their stacks, she should have been able to see it. And she couldn't see that. She didn't even say she's seen that.
Yeah.
So at one point she was whistling to try and get them to find her, but, like, it didn't work that way.
Yeah.
They didn't have the stuff to find her. She had the stuff to find them.
God, can you imagine, like, the panic?
Especially getting low on fuel?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was radio confusion, atmospheric distortion, miscalculated positions, possibly the failed antenna that was possibly missing.
Right.
Maybe even worse.
Yeah.
But then it went silent. Mm-hmm. No sightings, no crash, no wreckage. For 16 days, the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard searched 250,000 square miles of the ocean. Nothing. They were just gone.
Like, no.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I literally do not accept that. I dispute that, actually. Like, no. What do you mean?
Yeah. Like, how do you...
How do you...
Remember, we're... Damn, I said... They're still in the, 1937.
Yeah.
It's early. So, that's for them to spend so all that...
Crazy to me.
They spent a ton of money trying to find her. There's some theories. I'll tell you which one I think is...
Yeah.
What I believe is going to be the, like, best one. But now we'll go into some theories.
Right.
Again, I'm sure people are yelling at us. There's a ton of in-depth things.
Yeah.
I want to pique your interest. Mm-hmm. I want you to be inspired, mm-hmm. to look this stuff up, watch the documentaries.
Yeah.
Read. There's multiple books on this.
This literally makes me want to go home and mm-hmm. watch a documentary.
That's what I mean. I want with this episode to pique that interest.
Yeah.
People have done it. I don't want to bore you with all of that. I want your interest piqued for you to go and look into it. Some of the theories. There's the one that everybody kind of, the government and everybody kind of says is the crash and sink theory.
Yeah, just chalk it up to that.
It's the simplest, most widely accepted theory, yeah. I guess. She ran out of fuel. Hiram Noonan couldn't locate Helen Island. Though they were close, the final radio message received was a full strength by the Coast Guard cutter, Itasca. It indicated they were circling, low on fuel, desperately searching. And that's where, 8:43 a.m., she gave that last known transmission, and then it went quiet.
Right.
Aviation's expert, Elgin Long, spent decades investigating what might have gone wrong. In his book, Amelia Earhart, The Mystery Solved, Long lays out the crash and sink theory. Amelia likely ditched a plane into the ocean after running dry. Her Lockheed Electra, built for land, would quickly fill with water and sink. All
right.
The Pacific in that region drops over to 17,000 feet deep. Despite sonar scans, underwater robots, and relentless search missions, there's no confirmed wreckage ever found.
See, like, that's why I can't buy this, she just sunk and sank and crashed mm-hmm. theory. Because what do you mean? Not a single, nothing?
No.
Like, yeah. no
parts
debris,
of the plane,
nothing.
No nothing.
Mm-hmm. Over this long, mm-hmm. too, is insane.
Yeah.
Like, there would have to be something. If that's mm-hmm. the theory that we're going with, by now, I feel like we would have found something.
Yeah.
That's why I've always been like, no.
Mm-hmm. The next... theory is the castaway theory.
I'm roughly, very excited for these theories because I literally only know that one.
Like, oh, you only know the crash and sink?
Yeah. Like,
I think this, so, spoiler, this one I think is my,
okay.
my one that says this is what happened.
Yeah.
So, roughly 350 nautical miles southeast of Howland Island lies Nikumaroro, once known as, what?
What a name.
Yeah. Once known as Gardner Island. An isolated coral atoll in the Phoenix Islands chain. It's uninhabited at the time of Amelia Earhart's disappearance. It would later become the focal point of one of the most compelling alternative theories that Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, landed there and survived for a time.
Hmm.
This castaway theory proposes that Amelia and Fred, off course, unable to locate Howland, executed a controlled landing on the island's reef. The Electra may have been damaged, but intact enough to provide shelter. Of radio signals intercepted by professional operators, including some who recognize Earhart's voice, were reportedly transmitted from the region in the days following her disappearance.
That's kind of crazy.
Yep. So, what they're thinking is, with this, I may get into it in a second, is that when they landed on the reef, the plane was... Because obviously, the plane has to function. The propellers have to spin in order to get power, and the power is needed to power the radios.
Yeah.
So they're thinking that the plane was on the reef enough to where it wouldn't, like, none of the electronics would get affected.
Yeah.
So they were able to send signals out, and then, you know, when the tide came in, go to land, mm-hmm. and then when the tide went back out, go back out. Directional bearings from several stations, including those on the Wake and Midway triangulated Nikumaroro. In 1940, British colonial officers discovered a partial human skeleton on the island. Female, European, and of similar stature to Earhart. But the bones were sent to Fiji, and subsequently, poof, gone.
What do you mean, poof? Like, how do you just lose bones that
Fairly Odd Parents, poof.
That could literally, like, crack open a, like, thing that is so important. Like, how do we just lose that? And why did we send them to Fiji?
That's what I wanted to know. How'd they get sent to Fiji?
What was going on in Fiji? Mm-hmm. I don't like that. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Because what if that is literally what happened?
Remember, I didn't mention this. A lot of tension's going on, too, with Japan at this point. Because this is, like, cusp of World War II.
Yeah.
So.
Didn't even factor that in.
Mm-hmm.
Although, with this, they found that, and, like, okay, that explains her. Mm-hmm. But what about Fred? Where's Fred's skeleton?
We'll get there.
Oh, okay.
In the early 2000s, TIGAR, the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, which I'm glad I read that, because I heard it said so many times, and I had no idea.
That's the acronym.
I just knew it as TIGAR. They recovered and reanalyzed the data. Forensic anthropologists used modern software and concluded that the bones likely belonged to a woman of European descent standing between 5'5" and 5'9", just like Amelia.
Hmm.
There was some controversy with that because one person said that the bones were from a stocky male. Hmm. Now, that kind of got, I would say, more doctors have now, like, they sighed and they're like, no, it would be a female.
Right.
Like, there's no way they would have missed it. It was they'd be female bones.
Mm-hmm. You could tell the difference.
TIGAR, which has led multiple expeditions to Nikumaroro since 1988, uncovered tantalizing clues. A woman's shoe, which apparently is still a popular shoe to today. Like her boot, the boot that was worn.
Right.
Could be still popular today. Aircraft debris, remnants of fires, fish, and bird bones from meals, a mirror compact, a pocket knife, and glass jars, possibly containing ointments or cosmetics to protect against the sun.
Hmm.
One of the jars, analysts noted, was chemically consistent with the once common freckle cream. Amelia was known to not like her freckles. Zippers and other oddities were consistent with Amelia's clothing preferences, and the designs of her fashion collaborator, Elsa
Schiaparelli. Schiaparelli.
Yeah.
Come on, you should know that name.
I know, right? I'm sorry.
I know that one. Still famous today.
They also found a box of Brandy's nautical sextant, one likely issued by the U.S. Navy, and possibly similar to the one owned by Fred Noonan. The serial numbers on the box closely matched those of the sextants tied directly to Noonan and his work aboard the Pan Am Clippers. Perhaps the most compelling, a 1937 photo was taken offshore by a British officer, Eric Bevington, and appears to show an object on the reef's edge, an object later forensically analyzed and deemed consistent with the landing gear of a Lockheed Electra 10E.
Okay. So, hello. How is this not the most common theory?
Now, the other thing with the food, the fish, and everything like that, the locals, I guess you would say, of that area, they wouldn't just leave the fish head. They knew how to eat everything.
Yeah. So this was,
so,
like
they were finding things that were like fit. Yeah, they didn't. They seemed like they were castaways.
Yeah.
They weren't eating the fish heads. They had, like, shells of clams and stuff that had burn marks on them from fire. Like, they didn't really know how to cook these things. They were just doing it. So
for their life, like.
Yeah. TIGAR researchers believe that Earhart may have initially camped at what's now called Seventh Sight, using recovered gear, boiling water in jars, and fending off the harsh island environment. But survival couldn't last forever. With no consistent fresh water, she may have perished from thirst, her remains possibly eaten by the island's relentless coconut crabs. They left behind only 13 bones. So of those bones that were found, they found 13 of them.
Mm.
So they think that, like, the crabs probably just scattered her remains just everywhere.
Right.
So far, no artifact provides absolute proof. But in Amelia Earhart and the Nika Mororo bones, a 21st century forensic analyst, and earlier works like Finding Amelia by Rick Gillespie, Tigar continues to build a compelling circumstantial case. I think that one, to me, is, like, the biggest one.
Right.
I don't...
My whole thing is, like, what did you say it was? Yeah, they forensically analyzed and deemed it consistent with the landing gear of the... Come on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's...
They have no proof, though. It was there earlier, now it's not. So where'd it go?
Right.
Some say that it slid off the reef and deeper into the Pacific.
Yeah.
You know, some say...
Yeah, like, how could you not find it, though? Like, aren't you... Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you look, like...
They are. I mean, they are. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars. Oh,
it is crazy. I know.
Hundreds,
I'm like,
just look.
Just go look. Just go look.
You know, just take your little submarine and go look.
Right.
It doesn't work like that.
It's not that easy. Yeah.
So then we have the Japanese capture theory. Mm. Saipan. That is the... kind of the island where some of this takes place, but not where they were technically captured. Of all the theories surrounding Amelia Earhart's disappearance, fewer as chilling or as controversial as the Japanese capture theory. This version of events contends that Earhart and Noonan didn't crash and sink, and they didn't land on Nika Mororo. Instead, they survived the initial stages of their ill-fated flight, only to end up in the hands of the Japanese military.
See, like, you're really going to have to, like, explain this one to me. Because I'm like, how?
The hypothesis,
like,
places...
How?
I'm trying.
Okay.
Gosh. The hypothesis places them in the Marshall Islands, then under Japanese control, where they were allegedly captured, suspected of being American spies, and transported to Saipan in the northern Mariana Islands. The theory persisted for decades. Eyewitnesses of the Marshall Islands and Saipan have claimed that they saw a white woman pilot in custody or even witnessed her execution. After World War II, some American servicemen said they found the wreckage of Earhart's Lockheed Electra on Saipan hidden away by the Japanese. But hard proof? That remains elusive.
Hmm.
In 2017... this theory surged back into the public attention after the History Channel aired a documentary featuring a mysterious photograph discovered by a former federal agent, Les Kinney, in the U.S. National Archives. The image stamped by the Office of Naval Intelligence appeared to show a woman with a short haircut and a man resembling Noonan on the dock of Jowlett Atoll, with a Japanese ship towing barge carrying what some claimed was an airplane.
Hmm.
Facial recognition specialist Kent Gibson asserted that these figures were very likely Earhart and Noonan. Sean Henry, former assistant director of the FBI and NBC news analyst, confidently stated, quote, "When you pull out and when you see the analysis that's been done, I think it leaves no doubt to the viewers that's Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan," end quote. But the backlash was swift.
Well, yeah, because you can't say something like that and be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like...
No. No way. Rick Gillespie, author of Finding Amelia and executive director of Tigar, dismissed the photo as, quote, "just a picture of a wharf with a bunch of people," end quote. He pointed out that the same photo had been published in 1935 Japanese Travel Guide, 2 years before Earhart's final flight. It's just silly, he said, noting that Even the woman's hair was far too long to match the cropped hairstyle Earhart wore in photos taken days before her disappearance. Supporters of the capture theory argue that the Japanese may have destroyed or lost records during the war. Multiple local witnesses over the years claim to have seen a Caucasian woman and man held on Saipan under harsh conditions, and some stories say the pair were eventually executed. Despite the intense speculation, no confirmed artifacts, documentation, or remains have ever surfaced to definitively support this theory. No aircraft have been recovered, no graves located, no undeniable trail left behind. There's your Japanese theory.
Okay. And I get that. But, like, how did they completely just, like, take over them, like, in the air? Like, what do you mean? Like, so what is the
theory? No, they crashed.
Oh, they crashed or, and then the Japanese...
They crashed or they shot them down.
Okay. I was going to say, because what do you mean? How did they get the airplane, too?
Like, now, the other thing is those islands apparently weren't really in the range of the Electra, even, like, running out of fuel.
Right.
The chances were they probably weren't. Mm. So, that's another part of that.
That is definitely an interesting theory, for sure.
Yeah. And now, we get to the most shadowy chapter of Amelia Earhart mystery.
That wasn't it.
The spy theory.
Oh.
Bum, bum, bum. A theory that's less about aviation and more about espionage, global politics, and even government secrets.
Yeah, well.
According to this narrative, Earhart's 1937 world flight was not just a pioneering aviation journey. It was a covert mission orchestrated by the highest levels of the U.S. government. In his book, Amelia Earhart, Beyond the Grave, author W.C. Jameson claims that Earhart was secretly recruited by President Franklin D. Roosevelt. Didn't I say who that she was friends with?
I was literally just going to say, you literally said that she was friends with
I couldn't remember if I said Franklin or Theodore.
Yeah, well, either way.
To conduct an aerial reconnaissance over the Japanese military installations in the Pacific. Her flight path, which passed dangerously close to Japanese-held territories, became more than just ambitious. It became suspicious. Under this theory, the Lockheed Electra was armed with cameras, not just fuel tanks and maps. And as she flew over the hostile territory, the Japanese allegedly detected her mission, shot her down, and captured both Earhart and Noonan. But the story takes a darker turn. Some versions suggest that Roosevelt disavowed all knowledge of the operation, leaving Earhart and Noonan to die in enemy hands. They were sacrifices on the altar of international diplomacy. Their deaths, buried under layers of classified denials to avoid provoking war with Japan. Others go further, claiming she wasn't killed at all. Instead, she was held as a prisoner throughout World War II, only to be quietly repatriated under the new alias of Irene Blom, a New Jersey banker.
Huh.
Now,
that's interesting. Never heard that theory.
It's also said that she was a Japanese Rose.
Hmm.
I think that's what they called her. They called them. These were women who would, like, call or talk to U.S. soldiers or Allied soldiers and tell them that they're, like, oh, your wife's cheating on you, your girlfriend doesn't love you, go home now, and, like, do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And they were saying that they heard her voice a lot.
Hmm.
And George Putnam, her husband, he listened and listened and listened, and he never confirmed it. He denied it. Right. Now, whether it was confirmed behind closed doors...
What theory did he believe? Like, what does he think happened to her?
You know what? I don't know.
Just, like, out of curiosity, like, I wonder, like, what he thinks is
he probably goes with the crash and...
Yeah, well, because that's the most, like...
Yeah. I mean, it would also be
believe.
So much harder to believe that she was on Nikumaroro.
Yeah.
And, like, knowing that, like, we just didn't get there. Yeah. We didn't search there. Why didn't we go there? We, you know.
The not knowing literally would drive me insane.
Yeah. In the 1970s, the controversial book alleged that Amelia Earhart was Blom. Photos compared, voices analyzed. Blom, who emphatically denied the claim, sued the publishers and won.
Hmm.
Later, DNA testing conclusively proved that she and Amelia Earhart were not the same person.
It's actually kind of, like, knowledge, like, crazy that she didn't, like, buy into it. I feel like any other person would have been like, hell yeah, it's me. Like, well, yep.
She also has, like, a crazy, suspicious background.
Hmm.
There was a bunch of, like, her history and stuff that couldn't be found.
Hmm.
And she was an aviatrix at one point.
Ah.
And there was a couple other things. But I didn't think it was her.
Yeah.
Somebody, even if she was in, like, say that's her and she was in, like, the early forms of witness protection,
mm-hmm.
you're going to tell somebody.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to know.
Right.
Because there's not, like, it's not like you have a hit out for your head.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're only in witness protection to protect the, I mean, guess that's where the hit would come from.
Yeah.
To protect the government. But the damage was done. The idea of Amelia returning under a new name, living out her days in secrecy, had already cemented itself in conspiracy lore. There's one theory that does not appear in most textbooks, and that's the theory that blends aviation mystery with folklore.
Hmm.
Science fiction with speculative physics.
This is our kind of theory.
What if she didn't crash, but vanished into another dimension? The Bermuda Triangle, sometimes called the Devil's Triangle, is a region of the Atlantic Ocean bordered roughly by Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico. Since the mid-20th century, it's gained a fearsome reputation as the ocean's vanishing point. Planes disappear mid-flight, ships never reach their ports, radio contact ceases without warning, no wreckage, no distress call, no survivors. Some of the Triangle's most famous vanishings include Flight 19, a squadron of 5 U.S. Navy torpedo bombers that disappeared in December of 1945 during a routine training mission. That one, crazy. A rescue plane sent to locate them also vanished.
What, bro?
Yep. Yeah. So there was communication between them. You hear the pilot, like, they're talking, trying to find land, and then it just goes quiet.
Dude,
never seen again.
Bermuda Triangle is crazy.
They sent the rescue plane out to find them. Gone. Loses communication. Disappears.
Wild.
Between 1945 and 1970, dozens of aircraft and nearly 50 ships were reported lost in this stretch of sea, including a flight with 32 passengers that vanished without a trace. In 2017, a Turkish Airlines A330-200 experienced strange electrical and mechanical failures while flying over the region, forcing a diversion to Washington, D.C. So what does this have to do with Earhart? Geographically, nothing. Her disappearance occurred over the Pacific, near Hallen Island, thousands of miles from the Bermuda Triangle.
Hmm.
But some theorists argue the Bermuda Triangle isn't a place at all. It's not fixed, not bound. Instead, it's a phenomenon. A revolving rift, a tear in space-time that opens and closes like cosmic aperture. In this version of the story, the triangle briefly activated in the Pacific, just long enough for Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan to enter its field.
Hmm.
And then they were gone, pulled into a rotating wormhole, shifted into another dimension, lost in a time loop, or perhaps even taken by forces unknown. Aliens. The absence of evidence continues to haunt this theory. No wreckage. No oil slick. No floating debris. No emergency beacon. Just radio silence and empty sea. As if the ocean never touched her at all. Critics, scientists, aviation experts, and historians dismiss the Bermuda Triangle as pseudo-history. They cite human error, storms, magnetic interference, and mechanical failure as the true culprits. To them, the triangle is more myth than menace, an invention fueled by coincidence, poor record-keeping, and popular imagination. Now, they would be the theories. That is the last one, the triangle.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with you, honestly.
Nika Mororo?
Yeah, I think that's... Mm-hmm.
Now, they haven't found anything else there, though. That's the problem.
But, see, like, I feel like obviously the most believed theory is the crash and sink thing. My whole thing is, like, what the hell do you mean you didn't find a single ounce? Like, not a
nothing.
Trace.
Nothing at all.
Of evidence. Nothing.
So it's like it hit, stayed in place. And they had a float. Like, they right. had an emergency float with food and stuff on it. So if it would have... So they could have possibly gotten out. Like, they could have... You know, they landed in the Hudson.
Right.
Sully landed in the Hudson.
Yeah.
They could have pulled off, now you're talking early aviations, but right. they could have pulled off a water landing and gotten out. Or they could have bailed
yeah.
and gotten out into the thing, and they never, like, that was never found. Nothing was ever found. Now, the ocean's huge.
Yeah.
They could have drifted somewhere.
And so much of it is literally, like, isn't it, like, what is it?
The we percentage. Explored.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the percentage that we haven't even, like, explored.
Yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah. So now we have some modern searches and technological clues. So from 2009 to 2024, archaeologist Rick Pettigrew gathers and analyzes 29 satellite images of Terratata Point.
Is he related to Peter Pettigrew?
No. Could be, but not.
I had to ask.
Yeah. He believes a shape appearing in 2015 may be the fuselage and wing of Earhart's Electra. Previously buried and then revealed after cyclone activity. So, that's what he's been doing.
Hmm.
In 2012, underwater sonar scanning near Howland Island reveals a possible metallic object. While intriguing, no conclusive identification of an aircraft wreckage was made. In 2015, Josh Gates' Expedition Unknown. In the premiere episode, Josh Gates embarked on a journey to uncover new evidence about Earhart's disappearance. He travels to Papua New Guinea, exploring tribal lands, and then to Fiji, investigating claims that the artifacts that might be connected to Earhart. In 2018, forensic analysis is... A forensic analysis is conducted on bones recovered from Nika Mororo decades later. Researchers suggest that the remains may belong to a woman of European descent and of similar height to Amelia Earhart. However, the findings remain inconclusive due to the lack of DNA confirmation.
All right, and that was in what, 2018? Run it back. Do it again.
In 2019, August to be exactly, ocean explorer Robert Ballard, known for discovering the Titanic, leads an expedition to Nika Mororo, aboard the research vessel Nautilus. Funded by National Geographic, his team maps the island with sonar and deploys remote-operated vehicles to explore the surrounding reefs and underwater terrain. Despite extensive search efforts, no definitive evidence of Earhart's plane has been found. Some rock formations resemble aircraft parts, but none are confirmed. In November of 24, Rick Gillespie, head of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, TIGAR, publishes One More Good Flight, The Amelia Earhart Tragedy. The book defends the Nika Mororo castaway theory and suggests that Earhart may have survived briefly on the island. Despite skepticism, the book adds to the decades of research on the case. In 2025 to 2026, this is planned, Pettigrew continues fundraising for a two-phase expedition to the Tara Point. Phase one is a reconnaissance and has raised about 40% of the $900,000 budget, and phase two will involve a detailed investigation and potentially recover any aircraft debris found. Contributions can be reserved berths. Whew! Contributors can reserve berths aboard the expedition vessel with a $25,000 donation.
Just a slight $25,000.
So maybe we'll never know where she went. Maybe she never intended to be found. But what Amelia Earhart did accomplish was profound. Mm-hmm. She broke barriers, mechanical, societal, and cultural. She's more than a pilot. She was a symbol of defiance, freedom, and ambition. Even her disappearance became a metaphor for the limits of human reach. Quote, "Adventure is worthwhile in itself," end quote, she said. And perhaps that's all we need to know. To close us out, in Amelia's own words, everyone has oceans to fly. If they have the heart to do it, is it reckless? Maybe. But what do dreams know of boundaries? Never interrupt someone doing something you said couldn't be done. Some of us have great runways already built for us. If you have one, take off. But if you don't have one, realize it's your responsibility to grab a shovel and build one for yourself and for those who will follow after you. There's more to life than being a passenger. The most effective way to do it is to do it.
I love her.
And that closes us out on Amelia Earhart.
Like, she's literally such an icon. Mm-hmm. Like,
totally. The way she did break the barriers and do all that stuff is just awesome. And like I said, I'm hoping that, like, this piques a lot of people's interest to, like, want to dive deeper into it.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is going to get cut down, but we're an hour and a half into it. And, you know, I was vague.
Mm-hmm.
So, she's just an icon.
Yeah,
some literally still call her America's sweetheart. I think it was the Castaway Theory.
Yeah.
I think now, did you see the new Titanic thing on Disney Plus?
Mm-hmm.
They now have those robots that have went all the way down and can do that. I think if they deployed them puppies,
for sure,
you'll find something.
I know. They'll, seriously, it's crazy that, like, after all this time, we still don't have, like, anything more, like, anything closer.
Yep, and there's probably no DNA on those bones. They're probably sun-bleached and stuff like that. So,
God, and by now, like, geez.
Mm-hmm. So, I think that's I think it's going to be our cue to get out of here.
Yeah.
You guys have listened to us long enough. I'd say come back next week to do some haunted things, but, you know, this week was a little bit of a history mystery kind of deal, a search and find. But, you know, don't forget to come back next week. I don't think I'm going to tell you what we're diving into next week, but we're going back to spooky. Definitely getting into something a little creepy, something of a copycat, but go follow us on our socials. Please rate, review, like us, anything, wherever you listen. It doesn't matter. It all helps us get out there to people. Sam, who wrote this episode, kills it all the time for us with every episode she writes.
Yeah.
She has her own podcast, Scare Me Sam. If you're in the market for a haunted book or a thriller, she reviews them. Go check out her podcast. You can also check out her blog at scaremesam.com. She puts on some awesome little mini posts out there about some topics we've covered, some topics we haven't covered. So, you know, go check her stuff out too. It's not just us doing this. She's been a huge help. So, I guess with all that being said, I think we can. Oh, no. If you have your own story, or maybe you have your own theory about Amelia Earhart, reach out. Email us at theominousarchives@gmail.com. So, until next week, guys. See ya.
See ya.